From PRX, this is the Moth Radio Hour. This episode features three moth stories from African countries and one from Indonesia. If this is your first time listening to the show, hello and welcome. I'm Sarah Austin-Jeunesse from The Moth, and I'll be your host for this hour. At The Moth, we produce events where everyday people tell true personal stories for audiences all over the world. And each week, we share a few of them here with you. The four storytellers in this episode were all part of workshops that Larry Rosen and I taught with people working in global health. They're all New Voices fellows from the Aspen Institute. We asked them the not-so-simple question, why do you do what you do? Our first storyteller is Lindiwe Majele Sibanda, one of Africa's leading advocates for food and nutrition security. Her PhD thesis was about improving the productivity of indigenous goats. Over the course of our story workshop in Naivasha, Kenya, we ate all of our meals together, and it was over one dinner that Lindiwe said, "You know, I lost 80 pounds, and I've kept the weight off. I should tell that story sometime." And she did. That's the story you're about to hear. Here's Lindiwe, live at The Moth.
Part of my umbilical cord is buried in Lower Gweru village in Zimbabwe, at the doorstep of a thatched hut which used to be my grandmother's bedroom. My grandmother, Mayembe, was a great woman. Agriculture was in her blood. Her local community named her Mayembe, a Zulu name, which means a woman who wears overalls, because she worked hard. She would get us up at 4 in the morning, all in prayer, and her prayer was always, "I wish all my grandchildren would grow up to be farmers and feed not just their families, but the whole of Zimbabwe." She would work on her 1 acre plot where she kept goats, she kept cattle, she had a mixed farm with corn, she had an orchard, she had a vegetable garden, and she had a bean patch. And all this was to feed not just her 6 children and her 50 grandchildren, but the entire community around her. It is no surprise that I then chose a career in agriculture. I was lucky enough to get a government scholarship to go and study in Egypt. When I got to Egypt, life was not too different from Zimbabwe. But after my first degree, I got another scholarship to go and study in England. There, life was different. What was most different was the food. Right at the hostel where we stayed, they served us hamburgers. They served us French fries. They served pizza. And there was soda anytime you wanted. And I enjoyed that. 4 times a day, I would drink Coca-Cola. These are things I never afforded when I grew up. And when I saw it plenty and affordable, I enjoyed and indulged. I graduated and went back and took up a job at the local university. And within the first 2 months, I met my Mr. Handsome and got married. Life was fun. Just the 2 of us, graduates, working as professors at the university, we lived the life. We had arrived. We could eat out as much as we can, and Zimbabwe had moved on by then, and just next to the university, a food court had opened, and all the French fries, McDonald's, Kentucky Fried Fish, Kentucky Fried Chicken was just at our doorstep. Mr. Handsome would pick me up lunchtime. We'll go in our Mini Cooper car and park, open our doors, and enjoy pizza. And he loved his French fries. After work, we would go to the college bar every single day without fail, because that's where you caught up with the local gossip. We would drink all the sodas, anything we wanted. After that, we'd play squash or go swimming and then go out and eat out. There was no need to cook at home. After all, we're educated and development is about affording anything you want. That was the benchmark where we were. Within a year, I got my first child, a bouncing 9-pound baby. Just as well it was within the first year, because if we had delayed, village elders would have been summoned to sit us down to find out if there's a problem. So we got that right. My grandmother, who was still alive then, sent my eldest aunt, who is my favorite, Auntie Ellis, to come and look after me to make sure that in my new responsibilities of looking after this baby, I do not neglect Mr. Handsome, but also that I'm well fed with our traditional foods and would improve my milk laid down. So she prepared the traditional brew, she prepared all the lovely traditional foods, and my Aunt Ellis made sure every day at 5 a.m. I got a pot full of porridge to eat. I got my lunch with the goat meat that my grandmother used to prepare when I was a kid. And then for dinners, it was all the vegetables, all from my grandmother's field. Auntie Ellis used to stay 4 full months, and the idea being by 4 months, the baby's old enough to be weaned onto solids, and that's a good time for her to turn her back and go to her own farm in the village. The moment she turned her back, we went back to our fried French fries, because that's the food, that's the life. And the measure where I come from is when you eat out, it means you've arrived, you can afford. I had my second child after 3 years, and by the 5th year of marriage, I had 3 children. A lot had changed in those 5 years. I could no longer go and play squash and go swimming. But one thing that didn't change is the food that we ate. Even though Aunt Ellis would come those 4 months, we would still go back to our food. University-wise, I was doing very well. But one big change was my body. Before I knew it, I was weighing 220 pounds. The world told me I was happy. We come from a community where big means you can afford what you want to eat, you are happy, you are healthy, so what's your problem? You've got the money, spend it on yourself. So, because I was doing so well, I was asked and invited to go and speak in a global conference, which was on food security, the area I study. I prepared my speaking notes, and my message was very clear. Africa needs to feed Africa. We need to improve productivity, and our families can feed themselves. That's a message that was clear. I go to England, there were 3 keynote speakers. We took up the stage just like this one. The first speaker was from Europe, and he addressed the topic of global food security by unpacking that food security is about food you produce, is about access and markets. It's also about utilization, and developed countries are not doing well because they are wasting a lot of food. If only they could reduce waste, Africa would not be starving. I went, yeah, I'm going to get a great hook from that speech because I'm talking about an Africa that needs to improve productivity. The second speaker was from India. She took the floor and explained that in the 60s in India, they had gone through massive starvation. Big hunger, but thanks to the Green Revolution, they produced a lot of rice and a lot of wheat, but they are now facing hidden hunger. I went, oh, hidden hunger? That's close to what we're facing in Africa. But she went on to elaborate that as a result of this hidden hunger, there is obesity, there are diseases like hypertension and diabetes, and now they're facing stunting, massive problems, all to do with agriculture and nutrition. I sat on my chair, about to stand up, and when I was called, I looked down. There was I, wanting to represent a continent that is hungry, a continent that needs to increase productivity, and I was representing, in my body, an overweight person, overfed, and just the opposite of what I was standing to advocate for. I was filled with shame. As I stood up, I took the podium and started to talk, only to realize I had forgotten my speaking notes on my chair. Instead of going back to pick up my notes, I just rambled on and just went on and on for 20 minutes. I even forgot I had a PowerPoint I had to put up. I was just filled with shame. When I finished speaking, I took my position with the other speakers and waited for questions. Full 1 hour of questions, all directed at the two speakers and nothing for me. I knew I had messed up. The moment we stepped down, I went straight to my hotel, packed my books, and caught the next flight back home. I just could not face coming back to the conference. As I flew back to Zimbabwe, I was clear in my head. Something had to change. I got home. As I opened the door, looking forward to seeing my babies, guess who had come to visit? All without notice, Auntie Alice had come from the village. I was so excited because she was my favorite aunt. I was like, Auntie, you're here. This is great. She pulled back and said, girl, what has happened to you? What have you been eating? I got a flashback of the London conference and all the things I'd had, and I just tears started coming down my face. I'm like, Auntie, you can't do this to me. And she said, look here, we can fix this. Come and see what I brought for you. I brought all the harvest from my garden and from my farm. We've got to fix this. She went straight from the fridge and opened the fridge. 20 bottles of Coca-Cola. She just pulled them out and said, this is sugar. Get it out of your fridge. No more soda in this house. She went for our expensive pre-packed foods, the beggars, and she said, we're going to fix this. You've got to eat right. Auntie Alice stayed with us 4 months. The first 2 weeks were tough. I would wake up at night in sweat, dreaming that I had cheated and had a soda, just to realize that it's all a dream. My feet were sore, tingling sensation of just dehydration because I was craving for a soda, but I was so determined to make this work. End of first month, I had lost one dress size. By second month, I had lost two dress sizes, but at the same time, my friends were talking. Two brave friends came to me and said, are you sure you are okay? We come from a place where you lose weight, you need the doctor. And unfortunately, you don't need the doctor because of diabetes and hypertension. You need the doctor because it's HIV and AIDS. I assured them that this was deliberate. I wanted to change. But then they just smiled. I went on with the good food that Auntie was preparing. After 4 months, I had moved from size 20 to a size 12. Auntie turned her back and went. And now the same friends came to me and said, what drug are you on? We want that. As I go about my everyday work as an advocate for food security, I now emphasize nutrition security. Every day I wake up to cook for my family with my own hands, to cook my own food. And one thing I know for sure, my grandmother, my Yembe, is smiling in her grave. Auntie Alice, who is 110 years old now, is happy that I will get to her age, but I leave it to her. Thank you.
That was Lindiwe Majele Sibanda. Lindiwe coordinates agricultural development programs in 17 African countries. Lindiwe said one of her dreams is to become the Oprah of African agriculture with a talk show that's all about successful development stories. For her Auntie Ellis's 100th birthday party, Lindiwe and Ellis ate cake, of course, to see a photograph of the festivities and for the recipe of Lindiwe's favorite Zulu dish, tripe, mufushwa, and pap, go to themaw.org. Coming up next, a Ugandan boy and the meaning of an iron roof. See the whole world be looking at us.
Yeah, cause our land is our need. The Moth is supported by Boxed Wholesale. Boxed offers an array of warehouse-sized, non-perishable products from national brands, available via mobile app for delivery to the home or office. Featuring two-day delivery on most orders. More at boxed.com/moth. The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by PRX. I'm so happy to be a part of this continent. Call your sisters and your brothers and your friends. Let's
get together, let's hold hands and let us dance. Let's unite and give ourselves another chance. I see the waka for all the good things, many things, everything, the happy people, the jolly. Oh yeah, now let Africa be good. And in the sun or the rain or the sweet and the pain, we still be here together. Because let Africa be good. Oh, Nelson Mandela, Lupita Nyong'o, Desmond Tutu. Barack Obama, Kwame Nkrumah, all my freedom fighters.
You know what time it is. Let's go. Come on. Africa, stand up. Everybody move. Make a decision. Hands up. We came a long way.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Sarah Austin Jeunesse. This hour explores the developing world with stories about public health, agriculture, and education. All of our storytellers were part of workshops the Moth taught in Aspen, Colorado, and Naivasha, Kenya. Our next storyteller is James Kasaga, who was raised in rural western Uganda, and that's where this story takes place. Here's James with his Moth story.
As a 10-year-old boy growing up in rural western Uganda, I disliked how impermanent our grass thatched roofs were, particularly because I had spent most of my Saturday weekends going out to cut grass to replace this grass thatched roof. And after all that work, every month, these little rascals called termites would come and eat up the grass, and I'll have to do the thing over and over again. But my brother and I went out to do that because we had to do it because my father was ill in this hut with HIV. And my grandmother was helping take care of him. And so I did cut the grass, and my hands still bled. But I had to do it anyway. Until one day, my friend from the neighborhood, Asaf, came. And I always played soccer with Asaf on weekends when I didn't have to cut grass. And he said, "Are we playing soccer today? You know, I want to beat you this time." And I said, "Asaf, I am sorry I won't play soccer today with you. I have to cut grass to replace Papa's roof. Because, you know, he's sick and I don't want rain to fall on him." And Asaf looked at me and said, "You mean you have to cut grass all the time to replace the roof? Why don't you guys have an iron roof?" Like, in a way, you would say, "Dude, why don't you have an iron roof?" And so I had been to Asaf's family. I had spent time there once in a while. His mom would cook for us and would eat with them. And I had seen that they had this aluminum-looking roof, and it would rain, and they would collect water from the roof, and they would give people clean drinking water. And I thought, but why didn't we have an iron roof? And so, as I always did when I was confused, I had questions that needed clarity, I went to my grandmother. So I went to Kaka, the busy woman who was taking care of my father, and I said, "Kaka, you know, as a family have an iron roof and we keep cutting grass all the time. Why don't we have an iron roof?" And she always looked at me with her loving eyes. And she said, "My grandson, why don't you buy us that one iron roof one day?" And I knew then that we could not afford the iron roof. And soon, my father continued getting ill more and sicker and sicker. And his HIV progressed into AIDS. My brother, my elder brother, the one I cut grass with, dropped out of school so he can help take care of him. And I went off to school every single day, 7 miles away from school, run barefooted, would wake up 6 a.m., milk the cow, run off. And I continued to see that there was a struggle because there's need for clean water, there's need for firewood. As again, I went to my grandmother and I said, "Kaka, but why do I have to go to school every single day, 7 miles? I come home late at night. You need water, you need all these things. Can I stay and take care of Papa?" And this time she looked at me firmly and looked at me in my face again and said, Do you see why your brother is here at home? Do you see what I do every day to take care of your papa? You will stay in school. And so I went to school, unconvinced. I had to do it anyway. As a 10-year-old boy, I had to obey my grandmother. Until one morning, we received an invitation from one of my cousins, Stephen. The family had invited us for Stephen's graduation. Stephen had been the first young man to leave our community, our village, to go off to Kampala to study at university at Makere. And he was returning home for his graduation. And the village was excited. The young children were singing heroic songs. The women were grinding on their millet stones. The bull was slaughtered as culturally as it did, and the beef stew was in the air. The smells of curry. The tents were decorated with banana leaves and balloons. And I happened to come, and I sat in the audience like you were. And I had remembered Stephen. He was a ragtag young man who played soccer in the village, really shabby. This time he returned and he stood as the guest of honor. And he looked more regal and more confident, and he wore a suit and tie. And he had a graduation cap. And Stephen had graduated from Makerere and he had landed a job with the government as a paymaster. And he stood. And he spoke of the value of education. And he said, I have built a clean water well so you don't have to go farther to fetch water for my village. And he had built a clinic that mothers would give birth in that same clinic. They don't have to go 40 miles away to look for a place to give birth. And he said, for my family, I am building them an iron roof. And I remember looking at Stephen. And I was an okay student. But the next week when I went to school, I asked for more hours for my teachers so I could concentrate on geography and science and the things that I never understood. At 10 years old, you may be surprised, I created small little groups to solve math problems that I didn't understand. And I even did something crazy. I went out during the holidays for kids who had well-off parents who took them to boarding schools in the city, and I would borrow their papers and I would study at night so that I can prepare for the national exams that doesn't discriminate between. And so when the national exams came back, I was the best student in my county of 4 schools. And I was fortunate enough to receive a scholarship from the First Lady to attend high school in Kampala, the capital city, the magical place with lights. And that same opportunity, of course, led to my college sponsorship to come to the United States. 15 years later, I've returned to Uganda. And I had the opportunity to return to my village, and I fortunate, and I brought a clean water well to my village. For my family, I bought them a piece of land. And I was also able to build them an iron roof, but this time with solar panels. And I remember one Sunday morning, I walked with my kaka, my grandmother, to go to church, and we were walking up the hill. And as her feeble knees started, you know, to slow down, and she was holding my hand, and we stopped a little bit at the hill. And we looked at each other in the eyes as we were talking. She was telling me stories that I missed in the village, and I telling her stories of America and where I had been. And we looked at each other, and that moment I looked at her and I said, Kaka, how do you like your iron roof now? And she said, my grandson, I am now happy to die.
That was James Kasaga. James' father passed away from HIV/AIDS, leaving him orphaned at the age of 10. James now partners with secondary schools in Uganda to provide leadership development for youth. He says he has dreams of one day serving his country in a way that gives each and every Ugandan a fairer shot at life. To see a photo of James, his grandmother, and their iron roof being built, go to themoth.org. By the way, all the music in this hour was chosen by the storytellers. Next up, a story from Sisanke Msimang. Sisanke is a writer and activist dedicated to human rights and democracy. Here's Sisanke live at the Moth.
So I am the product of a freedom fighter and an accountant, which I guess would make me a pragmatic idealist. My father left South Africa when he was 21 years old to join the armed wing of the liberation struggle. And a few years later, he met my mother, who was, she wasn't my mother at the time, but he met an accounting student, a young accounting student who was charming and beautiful, and the rest, as they say, is history. So when we were growing up, my parents used to say things like, when we are free, one day when freedom comes, when liberation is here, and our favorite would be when Nelson Mandela is released from jail. And my sisters and I would look at each other and be like, yeah, right, like that's ever gonna happen, right? Nelson Mandela is gonna get out of jail. And of course he did. And not only did he get out of jail, but actually he was the first president of a free and democratic South Africa. And so fast forward, it's the mid-1990s, my family is back, I'm back from university, and I've landed my first job, and it's actually my dream job. I'm working for the United Nations on a program on young people and HIV and AIDS. And so, of course, it's a pragmatic idealist dream come true, right? On the one hand, it's the UN, so it's like, love, peace, and happiness. And on the other hand, let's face it, the UN is like the world's biggest bureaucracy, right? So it's like rules and systems and procedures, and like I'm in heaven, right? Both at the same time in one place. So it's great. So I'm very happy. I'm also really excited because I get to throw myself into my new country and this new job all at the same time, because by this time it's clear to me that while my parents' generation, for them, the struggle was one to end white minority rule, for my generation, the struggle is going to be slightly different, right? For us, it's going to be the tangibles. It's going to be health and education and water and sanitation, the things that you kind of need to know stuff about, right? So I throw myself into reading and research and trying to figure out as much as I can because I'm the pragmatic idealist, right? So I've got to figure out how to do this stuff. And so I can tell you everything about HIV and AIDS and young people because that's what my new job is about. I can tell you about the key elements of a plan for the syndromic management of STIs. I can tell you how many young women living in the northern KwaZulu-Natal district of Hlulhlwe, age 15 to 19, are living with HIV. I can tell you the likelihood of HIV transmission in a single-sex act. Like, I am on it. And then, of course, I meet Prudence. So I'm sitting in my office one morning, no doubt with my head buried in some or other, research report, and this kind of whirling dervish of a mad, sort of dreadlocked teeth and joy and laughter person kind of plunks herself in front of me. And she introduces herself. And like me, she's a young woman who's working for the UN. And while I was working on a program on young people and AIDS, Prue was working, she was one of the first people living openly with HIV and AIDS in South Africa. And so she was working for the UN to help to reduce stigma in the workplace. So she was hired to kind of demonstrate to employers that like people living with HIV aren't going to bite, right? And that you can actually hire people living with HIV and there's going to be no negative consequences for you or your bottom line. And so we had a lot in common. And so we hung out, not just in the office, but on weekends. You know, there were concerts and there were plays, and South Africa was this like amazing new blossoming place with this fantastic new constitution, and everybody had rights. And Prue and her sort of mad group of friends were all lesbians, which was like fantastic for me because like my cool points shot up like 1,000%. So it was wonderful. It was great. It was a wonderful, wonderful time. But of course, it wasn't as simple as things seemed on the surface. After some time, it became clear to me that Prudence was in a very violent and abusive relationship. And so I pulled her aside and I was like, Prue, like, what's going on, man? You know? Like, you're the most confident, amazing woman I know. What's happening? And she was like, doesn't matter, right? It doesn't matter, because what's going to happen is you need to get out of this relationship, and the way you're going to get out of that is you're going to move in with us, right? There's plenty of space in our house. Come and live with us. And so before you knew it, Prue was living with us, and of course, there wasn't a lot of space, so she was living in my room, and actually, she was not just staying in my room, she was staying in my bed, so we were like chatter, late into every night, and we would get up in the morning and go to the office, exhausted because we were talking so much. And twice a week, because Prudence had managed to wangle her way into this experimental drug treatment program, because these were the days before antiretrovirals were widely available, twice a week we would get on the highway from Pretoria, where we lived, and drive to Johannesburg to the doctor's office, where she would, you know, have the meds. And I remember the first time we got to the doctor's office, I parked and I took the key out of the ignition, you know, ready to get out, and Prue was like, no, you stay here. And I'm like, oh, but we do everything together. Okay, stay in the car. And so Prue went in, and the drive back was in silence, right? There was no talking. And so this happened twice a week, every week, for a few weeks. And after a couple of weeks, the meds were clearly, you know, starting to have their effects on her, and we got to the doctor's office one morning, and she needed help. There were two steps to walk up to get into the doctor's practice, and so she needed some help, and so I got out to help her, and, like, inside, secretly, I'm like, you know, I'm feeling really bad that she's not feeling well, but thank God I get to go inside, because now I see what's going on in there, right? So so we go inside, and it's the little room, and it's about 12 to 15 people who are sitting in that room, and it's this deathly silence. And contrary to what all the headlines were telling us at that time about what AIDS looked like, right? AIDS is a black disease, AIDS is a gay disease, AIDS is a disease of poverty. Actually, this room didn't look like that at all, right? It was a fairly affluent middle-class room. But it was clear that nobody in that room wanted to be there. So it was like this deathly silence. And so we kind of crept in and we sat down. And, you know, people would be called one by one. And the receptionist called this name. And it was, you know, first names only. And she called Alice. And Prue stands up. And she goes inside. And I'm like, huh. And she comes back out after about, 30 minutes or so. And we go back into the car. And we start making the long, silent trek, you know, back to Pretoria. And so I'm driving, and I look at her, and I say, what's he like? And Prue says, what's who like? And I said, the doctor, what's he like? And she looked at me for a long moment, and she said, he won't touch me without gloves on. And I realized that my friend, right, my brave, courageous, amazing friend who is openly living with HIV at a time when people are getting killed for that, right? Who is an out lesbian at a time when women were getting killed for that, still are, actually, right? That she's also petrified and vulnerable and ashamed of herself, right? And that's not a contradiction. That's all of us. That's life, right? It's all happening at the same time. And so in that moment, Prue taught me a really powerful and important lesson, a lesson that I have carried with me in 20 years as an activist and as an ally with people living with HIV and AIDS. And it was a lesson that was basically that, you know, it was fine to be a pragmatic idealist, right? That pragmatism is good and idealism is good. But that what I was missing was empathy. And that And that if I was going to make any kind of difference, if I was going to, that I wasn't actually listening to what Prue was saying. I was kind of listening, but I wasn't listening enough, right? And that if I was going to make any kind of impact, and if I was going to be the kind of advocate that I wanted to be, that what I was going to have to do was listen, not just to the words of people like Prudence, but much more importantly, I needed to listen to the silences.
That was Sisanke Msimang. Since Sisanke told this story, she decided to apply pragmatic idealism to her approach to motherhood. She's taking some time off to listen to her children, and she says, quote, boy, can they talk. After our break, a marine expert hatches a plan to bring back fish to Bali.
All thy children shall reap what you've sown.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
My brothers and sisters, stand up and sing.
I'm Sarah Austin Jeunesse, and you're listening to the Moth Radio Hour. This episode features world health experts. They were used to addressing audiences with PowerPoint and statistical research. Most had never put themselves in their material. The Moth taught storytelling workshops, asking them to remind themselves of what they were doing in plain speech. Many of them told us afterwards that this helped them tap in and reconnect to their work. The last story in this hour is told by Jensi Sartin. Jensi grew up in the rainforests of Borneo before moving to Bali to become an advocate for the world's oceans. Here's Jensi Sartin.
I was sitting on the beach in Bali. It's a beautiful beach. And I was waiting for sunset. And I see from afar a small traditional boat came ashore. And of course, a fisher was in there. And the boat just ashore. And that's the first time I met Nyoman, the fisher. So I helped him push his boat to the land, make sure that it's safe enough from the wave. And while we pushing the boat, I asked this very, very simple question to Nyoman. I say, so how's your day? Did you catch lots of fish today? And hopefully the big ones. And he say, well, I wish. But unfortunately, you can see. He pulled some bucket and yes, it just few fish. And they are small. Actually, as a marine biologist, scuba diver, I really know what Nyoman said. Yes, this is Bali. And like all other island in Indonesia, this is paradise. And I believe most of you will say Bali is a paradise. And yes, this is the center of world's coral reef. This is the place where you can see all the beauty, all the most colorful coral reef beauty of all the fish in the world. But if you go deeper, things actually different. The coral is destroyed, coral is damaged, and there are not many more fish out there. And this is not just about 75% of world's coral reef gone extinct. It's not just about the fish that will just disappear. This is about people. Because there are lots of people that depends on this coral reef. There are a lot of people like Nyoman and other Nyoman that depends on this fish, this healthy coral, to feed their family. It's about Nyoman as a dad that depends on this coral, this fish, to ensure that he can send his kids to a good school. And I said to Nyoman, well, okay, so have you discussed this problem with the government, our fisheries official? And Nyoman just said, well, the last time I did it, they have no clue what to do. And then while Nyoman, like, you know, trying to clean his boat, taking the fish out of the boat, he said this very, very, I never really expect this coming from Nyoman. He said, life is difficult. And sometimes you just have to accept it. When Nyoman said that words, it's like a deja vu for me. Like, I've been there before. It was like few years ago when I'm still little kids, and I and my parents, we're living in deep rainforest in Kalimantan, in Borneo. So I just like, 12 years old kids. And that time was just amazing. I remember I see all these exotic birds, all the animals, the orangutan. There are lots of them. And I remember, clearly remember, the tree just amazing. So if we want to hug a tree, it needs about 10 of us holds hand together just to hug a tree. And like, wow. But somehow, there are lots of foreign timber company coming to my forest. And what they did? They chopped down all the tree. They cut down all of my trees. And then somehow again, they leave us. Which is later on I learned that it was the time when we have the Asia financial crisis. And I asked my father, "Dad, what's going on here? Why these people coming and then just cut down all of my trees and then no more beautiful birds, no more orangutan here, and they just leave us with nothing?" And my dad that time just said, "Well, it's very difficult to understand. And sometime in life, you just have to accept it." Well, that time I just like, 12 years, little kids. But that time, that moment when Nyoman said the exact same words, sometimes in life you just have to accept it. I'm already 24 years old. I understand it. And I say, well, this is not right. So a courage growing inside of me, and I said to Nyoman, well, Nyoman, if you think you deserve better life, you have to fight for it. And Nyoman just like busy cleaning his boat. And then he stopped and suddenly looking at me and he said, "Well, Jensi, if you can bring back the fish, we will fight again." I said, "Well, okay." So right the next day, I met with the government of go to the government office, talking with the official, and I say I discussed this problem, and just like what Nyoman said, they have no clue what to do. So I come back and then meet Nyoman and his fellow officers. I say, "Okay, Nyoman, just like you said, the government no clue, but I have a plan. I have an idea." So I say, we will make a fish bank. And Nyoman just said, "What? Fish bank? Fish bank?" And I say, "Yes, fish bank. Just like your normal bank where you save your money, our fish bank, instead of saving money, we will save our fish. So this is how we're gonna do this. We will select some part of your fishing ground, the place you always fishing. We will close the area. We will protect it so no one go there to fish. No one go there to catch our fish. So the fish can grow in bigger and bigger and then makes a lot of baby fish and the fish growing bigger and bigger again. But you can still fishing. You can continue your fishing activities, but not inside the fish bank, but outside the fish bank, because fish swim in and out." And I'm thinking, well, it sounds makes sense. And I say, "Well, I learned this fish bank from the time when I'm still in the university, and it works in some places in Philippines, things like that. But I'm not really sure. There are a lot of variation in nature." And Nyoman said, "Well, let's give it a try." But then we don't know what to do. None of us like finish our elementary school actually. So I said to Nyoman, "Well, we will work together." So I help them. I teach them some skill. I teach Nyoman and his fellow officers scuba diving, so they can see how things work underwater. So this fisherman now become scuba diver. And then see the fish moving there, like things like that. And then I teach them also how to do like checking whether the coral is growing, whether the fish is growing bigger or more abundant, more many more fish there. And they also really, you know, guard the area. They protect it, like the security. And then 1 year passed by, and we have this very specific traditional ceremony for this fish bank. So it's like asking for blessing and also being thankful for what we've done. So we have this priest come in and pray for the fish bank and then sending all the prayers. And also lots of villagers come in, the small one, also the parents coming, bringing all the offerings. So it's like very sacred ceremony. But also we have like the young ones, the girls, the boy, they, you know, this traditional dancing, the Kecak dance, the Balinese dancing. So it's like a sacred ceremony, but also fun. So, and they invited me to come to the ceremony. So I go to the ceremony, and Nyoman and his fellow officers and some of the elders come to me and say, "Jensi, a few days ago, we just checked our fish bank. And you know what we found? There are lots of fish in the fish bank. And not just a lot. They are big. They are big ones. And not just inside the fish bank. It's also outside the fish bank. There are lots of big fish outside the fish bank. So next time you ask me, how is my day? Did I catch lots of fish today? I will say definitely yes, Gen Z. I catch lots of fish, and not just lots, they are big ones. And Nyoman like take my hands and hold it really, really deep. And he say, Gen Z, the fish bank works. We bring back the fish. You bring back the fish. You bring back our hopes. Thank you.
That was Gen Z Sartin. Gen Z is the director of Reef Check Foundation. He's still documenting the health of Indonesia's coral reefs and devising community-based strategies to protect them. He says, I tried to find a photo of Nyoman above the water, but am only able to find him underwater checking our fish bank. To see that shot and one of the Balinese fish bank ceremony, go to themoth.org. While you're there, you can pitch us your story by recording it right on our site. That's it for this episode of the Moth Radio Hour. We hope you'll join us next time.
Your host this hour was Sarah Austin Jeunesse. Sarah also directed the stories in the show, along with Larry Rosen. The rest of the Moth's directorial staff includes Catherine Burns, Sarah Haberman, Jennifer Hickson, and Meg Bowles. Production support from Whitney Jones. This hour was made possible thanks to the generosity and support of the Aspen Institute and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. The Moth would also like to thank Rachel Stretcher and Andrew Quinn. Moth stories are true, as remembered and affirmed by the storytellers. Moth events are recorded by Argo Studios in New York City, supervised by Paul Ruest. Our theme music is by The Drift. Other music in this hour was chosen by the storytellers and came from David O, Tiwa Savage, Sarkody, and Lola Ray, Damascus Kafumba, Miriam McCabe, and Niji. You can find links to all the music at our website. The Moth is produced for radio by me, Jay Allison, with Vicki Merrick at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. This hour was produced with funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. The Moth Radio Hour is presented by PRX. For more about our podcast, for information on pitching your own story, and everything else, go to our website, themoth.org.